Well, good morning, Faith Community. How are you doing this morning? Good. My name's Tim Porter. I'm one of the pastors here, and I know I say this often, but it does my heart great encouragement to know that you regularly attend worship and that you see a worship gathering as an important means to growing and following after Jesus. Thank you, Faith Community, for being here regularly. And then also, if you're a guest here, thank you for taking the extra effort and making the extra effort to be here this morning. I know that there's a lot of the places you can be. You can be up in an air balloon right now if you wanted to be. But I saw one come down yesterday. I don't know if I want to go up in one. So no one was hurt. It was just a rough landing. Anyway, let me just start simply this way. I am a man in need of desperate help. I am regularly in need of help, and it's not just that I need help fixing things around our house or repairing our vehicles or finding a good doctor or dentist or figuring out how to help our son walk through the steps of applying for college, university. I need regular help for my soul. For my heart. When I pay attention, I notice that in a normal week, I am discouraged, overly burdened, anxious, fearful, overwhelmed, self-righteously angry, ashamed, apprehensive, self-protective, insecure, selfish, hateful, impatient, and prideful, and that's a good week. In a normal week, I am overzealous, too excited about temporary good things, not excited enough about eternal weighty things. I get too enamored with people liking me, and I am too lackadaisical with resting in the weighty, powerful, and steadfast love of the living God. My priorities are easily jumbled up and distorted, and that leads to making bad decisions, frustrating and disappointing, and sometimes hurting the people I love most. I am a needy man. My soul needs help. Now, I mention this not because I want to get some kind of sympathy from you, or because I think I'm different or special. I mention this because as I've lived in Hudson since 2001 and I've been a pastor at Faith Community, I've got to know many of you. I mention this because I know many of your stories and I know that you're just like me. Your heart needs help as well. Your soul needs help as well. You're in need of help, not just with changing your circumstances to try to make your life better. Your heart needs help. I mean, think back over your own sort of normal week, whatever that is. Throughout this week, I bet that you have been afraid, overwhelmed, burdened, insecure, selfish, ashamed, hateful, too easily enamored by other people liking you, and too unexcited about eternity with God. Just this week, your priorities have been disordered in your heart, and you have made decisions, and you have said things to people that have disappointed, hurt, and sinned against them, people that you love. And if we look out into our neighborhoods, we see that our neighbors are just like me and just like us in need of help, doing the very same things. We are a needy people. Now, one of the reasons why I want to mention this as well is because often, we don't like to let other people know that we need help. I mean, how many of us would rather go help somebody else in need than tell somebody else that we need their help? It's the reality about us as human beings. We don't like to let other people know that we need help. I'm always shocked at a funeral when someone gets up to say something powerful about someone who's died and how they're going to miss them, they say, "I promised myself I wasn't going to cry." Why? You're at a funeral. We don't like to let other people know that we're hurting. Because then we know that we're needy. We need comfort. And we don't want other people to know that. We don't want to expose ourselves. But if we don't let other people know that we are in need of help, this leaves us in a catch-22. We won't get the help that we actually need and the help that's actually there to help our hearts, to help our souls when we are ashamed or afraid or insecure or too easily enamored by the pleasing of other people. And so today what I want to do is I want to talk about an underutilized resource, an underutilized resource for care and help for our souls. But one of the conditions to be cared for, to have your heart cared for, is to admit that you need care. What is the underutilized resource for our souls? It's one another. It's one another. One another, not just to help one another who gather here, but to help one another in our neighborhoods, to see neighborhoods renewed and the valley renewed by one another. Today we're looking at Romans 15, verses 14 through 16. It's found on page 949 of the Bibles in front of you. We'll read it in a moment, but as you're turning there, I want to give a little bit of a context for these verses. Now, last year, we spent time in Paul's letter to the Romans, and if you weren't here with us last year, you can go on our website, fcchudson.com, and you can stream all our sermons on the letter to the Romans. And the verses that we're reading here today, Paul is telling the Roman church why he is writing to them this letter. It's a church he didn't found. He knew many of the people there, but he didn't found that church. And he's telling them that he's writing to them to remind them of the gospel. See, the Roman church wasn't like the church in Corinth or the church in Philippi, where there's all kinds of problems there that Paul was writing to try to fix. The Roman church was actually well established in the gospel. And Paul is telling them that he's writing them to remind them of the gospel. He's writing to remind them of God's purposes in human history and to secure their support to send him to Spain, to people who didn't know anything about the gospel yet. But in these verses, Paul says something very encouraging and beautiful to the Roman Christians about who they are and what they're capable to do with one another. And what he writes in verse 14 is something that every elder and pastor of every church should have on the forefront of their mind of what their church should grow to become like. We're going to look at three movements here today. The call is to counsel one another. And then Paul gives us some qualifications of what we need to grow into to be able to counsel one another. And then we're going to look at last at the great counselor. Verses 14 through 16. I myself, Paul says, am satisfied about you, my brothers, that you yourselves are full of goodness, filled with all knowledge, and able to instruct one another. But on some points I have written to you very boldly by way of reminder, because of the grace given to me by God to be a minister of Christ Jesus to the Gentiles in the priestly service of the gospel of God, so that the offering of the Gentiles may be acceptable, sanctified by the Holy Spirit. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. Now, before we jump into this text and we jump into this sermon, I want to mention a couple things as we talk about the church as an underutilized and powerful resource for helping one another with our soul problems. As a pastor, one of my goals is to see this reality increase in us as a church. But in so doing, a clarification. What I'm about to say in this sermon, in no way, not for a moment, am I seeking to diminish the importance of professional and specialized Christian counselors. I have been helped deeply, personally, by them. But what is very fascinating, and those of you who are Christian counselors here that are specialized and trained, you know this to be true as well. What's fascinating is that professional and specialized Christian counselors, both those that I know personally and those that I listen to and learn from, tell me that an equipped church can handle far more of soul problems than what we tend to think we can handle. And we can even do it at times in better ways. Ed Welch, a Christian counselor, writes this. It's amazing. God is pleased to use ordinary people in ordinary conversations to do extraordinary, wise, or heavy lifting in his kingdom. And when he says, when he's talking about the heavy lifting of the kingdom, he's talking about the care of the heart of one another's souls. So today what I hope to do is cast some vision about what it looks like for us as a church to grow, to learn how to counsel one another. It's the first point. That's what we're called to do, I think. Roman church is a model for us. At the end of verse 14, Paul praises the Roman Christians that they're able to instruct one another. Now, verse 15, Paul says that he's writing to remind them. We all need reminding, even if we know everything we need to know about the gospel in our hearts. We still need reminding, and that's why Paul's writing to them. But Paul is acknowledging to this church that they have been trained well and they have been established well by their elders and pastors and leaders in the important things of the gospel. And for us as a church, one of the outcomes of our seeking to build a culture of discipleship here at Faith Community is that we would increase our ability to counsel one another and care for one another's hearts and souls. Now, you may be wondering, as you're looking at the text in front of you and you're looking at the slide above me, Paul says that you're able to instruct one another, and I'm saying you're able to counsel one another. Why am I doing that? Am I just playing fast and loose with the Word of God? No, I don't think so. The reason why I say counsel one another is that the word that Paul uses to talk about instruction is broader than how we tend to use the word instruction. When we talk about instructors, we tend to think about someone who transfers a body of knowledge from one person to another. But Paul's word for instruction is better understood under what a wise counselor does with a counselee, with what a discipler does with someone who's being discipled. It includes teaching, but it's also correcting and exhorting and encouraging and training and modeling, apprenticing, and showing somebody else how to do this. And it includes rebuking. This is what wise counselors do. That's why I'm using the word counsel here. So when Paul says that the Roman Christians are able to instruct one another, he means the full range of instruction for change, or the full range of helping one another change. See, the goal of instruction, the goal of Christian counseling, the goal of counsel with one another is to live differently from a transformed heart. It's to help the insecure rest. It's to help the fearful be courageous. It's to help us when we're anxious to trust. It's to help those who are enslaved to live freely. It's to help the prideful become humble. It's to help the apathetic be passionate in loving God and loving others. It's to help the hoarder become generous. That's what counseling's about. That's what the church is for. One of the ironies that I've found over the years is that many of us are intimidated to see ourselves as counselors. I think we've got like 70 people who've gone through biblical counseling training here, and it's hard to cross that jump from getting the training to actually doing it. It's intimidating to see yourself as a counselor. The irony is, do you know that you counsel all the time? We are constantly giving advice to one another. Constantly giving advice to one another. Oh, it's okay, you deserve it. Even the advice, the counsel to get counseling is counsel. We're constantly counseling one another. And so what Paul's calling for here, and what God seeks to do is not to make us into something that we're not already doing. It's to reform what we are already doing all the time with the scriptures. It's not we don't counsel and therefore we're going to counsel. It's we counsel. Are we counseling well? Are we giving godly counsel? Are we helping one another change to look more like Jesus? So Paul gives three qualifications here in this passage for growing as a church to be able to counsel one another and care for one another's souls. Three of them in this passage. And this verse isn't an exhaustive list, but these are the foundational elements for a church and individuals for us to grow in if we're going to help one another change into Christ-likeness and if we're going to care for one another's hearts. First is to be filled with goodness. That's what Paul says in verse 14, that the Roman church was filled with goodness. Now this phrase, filled with goodness, what that means, what Paul means by this in the context, it's actually a rare word, but in the context, it means that to be a good counselor, we must actually love and care for the people that we're giving counsel to. We must love and care for them. You're interested, deeply interested in that other person and their heart. And one of the reasons why we need to mention this, and I think why Paul describes it here, is because we tend to think about, well, we love people in general, but we don't actually love people in general. We only love people in particular. We love people in particular. And it takes time to grow in love for others, to be interested in another. It takes time to listen and to pay attention to another's hearts and to hear what's really going on in their lives and in their hearts. And being filled with goodness means that you listen to understand and you listen to not respond. You listen to make sure that you understand what's going on in somebody else's heart. And to be able to do that, you have to love that person. So if we're going to be a church that's able to counsel one another, we must grow not in love for one another in general, but in love for one another in particular. I love and care for this person. What this means is that if all you know is sort of a love for people here in general, is to take the next step and get more connected here at Faith Community. We'll have a connection center. I'll say more about that at the end of the service. You can take the next step and to get connected here. Join a missional community. If you have one meeting in your area, in your neighborhood, join that missional community and get to know people in particular to grow in love for particular people. Invite someone over for dinner from Faith Community that you don't know. Get to know people. Take the initiative. We're mostly Scandinavians here, Northern Europeans here. What that means is we have to initiate inviting people over. We tend to like to mind our own business. And when we do that, we don't get to know one another and know our hearts. Make sure you're inviting your neighbors over. Pray that God would give you a love that you're deeply interested in your neighbor's welfare. You won't be able to help them in their hearts if you don't love them. As we grow in love, in particular for one another at Faith Community, and as we grow in love, in particular for our neighbors, we actually become a very valuable resource in God's kingdom to help one another with our soul and heart problems. We could actually renew the valley if we, in particular, love our neighbors. Second qualification. I'm going to do a bit of a deep dive here, and then I'll pull us back up, but I want you to hang with me. That we need to be filled with knowledge. First is we need to be filled with goodness. The second is we need to be filled with knowledge. Now, when Paul says here that we need to be filled with knowledge, he's not saying that we have to that we have to know everything about everything that ever existed in all human space, time, and history. That's not what he's talking about here before we can actually counsel somebody. What he means, though, is that we need to have a solid understanding of what the scriptures teach. And in particular, I want to mention two things here today. One is I'm really liking the word particular this morning. I'm sorry. I want to mention two things in particular this morning about what we need to know about what the Bible teaches. The first is the human heart. How the Bible describes the human heart and how the human heart works. The second is to know the gospel really, really well, to apply it to the heart. First, we need to know the Bible's view of the human heart. The Bible helps us know why we do what we do and what is wrong with humanity and what needs to be fixed for humanity to be as we are made to be. Do you know why you do what you do? Do you know that? Do you know why you do what you do? You and I, we do what we do because we want what we want. At the core of human personality, at the core of who we are, is our desires. Our desires. This is why we do good things, and this is why we do evil things. Why did you take a baby bottle last week for Options for Women and fill it up? I wanted to help women who were in need. There you go. That's why you did it. Often, if you just listen to how we talk about why we do what we do, we tell one another why we're doing what we're doing. Listen to our talk. Why? So I'm going to go some extreme examples here, but for the sake of point, right? Why did you get drunk? I wanted comfort. Okay? Why did you lie? I wanted to protect my reputation. Why did you leave your wife? I wanted someone who would actually meet my needs. Why did you call in sick to work today? You don't seem sick. I wanted some time to myself. I had a hard week. If we listen to one another, we'll tell one another why we do what we do. It's because we want what we want. We're always doing what we want to do. Paul in Romans 13, 14, a few chapters before the text for today, says, "Put on the Lord Jesus Christ and make no opportunity for the flesh to gratify its desires." If you grew up with the King James, it's to gratify its lusts. What are we at our core? At our core, the Bible tells us, is that we are a people who desire and desire strongly. And that is why we do what we do. Thomas Cranmer coined an important phrase reflecting how the Bible describes what we do, what we do. He says this is important. What the heart loves, the will chooses, and the mind justifies. What the heart loves, the will chooses, and the mind justifies. So what he means by that is, whatever I love most, I'm going to choose to do, and all of my rational capabilities are going to justify why I need to do it. That's one of the reasons why we can be sinning at times and not feel like we're sinning and not even believe why we're sinning. Why? Because we've got all kinds of mental justifications for why we're doing what we're doing and why it's the right thing for us to do. Because we want to do it. The core of human motivation is our loves, our desires. And what's unique about the Bible is that the Bible talks about how our desires are not just for sinful things. That's why we do sinful things. It's not just simply because we desire to do evil things. It's because we actually desire too much really good things. Our loves get disordered. Our desires get disordered. We want really good things too much, which leads to a disordered living. Let me see if I can try and connect a dot here. You hear probably from us at times, and this is part of the culture here at Faith Community, where we talk about idols of the heart, that we have idols. And when the Bible talks about idols, it's not just simply talking about bowing down to statues and worshiping statues, though it does mean that. It also means idols of the heart. And what the Bible's getting at in Ezekiel 14 in particular is, there's that word again, in particular, is that when we want a really good thing too much, that desire for a really good thing, that uber desire for a really good thing is ruling our hearts, and it's functioning like an idol in our hearts. So the Bible uses the vocabulary, the phrase, idols of the heart, in an evocative way to arrest our attention so that we don't want really good things way too much. We can see it as an idol, and we need to see it as something that needs to be disordered or reordered in our hearts. You and I, we can be a force for really good work in one another's lives when we understand what the Bible teaches about human motivation and what's at the core of human behavior. What's at the core? Desire. What do you want is what you will live for. But we need to know more. Not just what human motivation is, and not just how human motivation gets disordered, but what's the solution for it? We need to know the gospel. See, the Bible contains a message that you can't get anywhere else, and the Bible calls it the gospel, and gospel just simply means good news. What is this gospel? In a fuller sense, it's this. God is the creator, and he made us and we belong to him, but we have rebelled and thinking that we could do life without God. Because of this rebellion, right now our lives are broken, the world is broken, and we have earned before God just condemnation. But God, who is so good, is not only just, he is also merciful, and he loves us, and he seeks to do us good, and he has made a way to restore us back into relationship with himself, and he's done this by sending his son to live the life that we should have lived and die the death that we should have died in our place and to rise again. And Jesus willingly did that. And right now, Jesus rules over human history, and one day he's going to return and bring the world to rights. And until then, God has sent his Spirit into our lives to change our hearts and give us power to actually change, to tell us of the depths of God's love for us so that we can rest our hearts in him, that we can see that God is our ultimate refuge, our great comfort, our provider, our righteousness, our forgiver, and give us the power to live so that we can change to become like Jesus, increasingly so. So that's the solution. And what's amazing about this solution, that message that it gave you, actually becomes the background, the foundational, the spinal cord for all of Christian living. It goes something like this. If you know the gospel, you know a purpose for your life, to live for God's glory. If you know the gospel, you know the reason why you should go to work every day. You work for Jesus to honor him, no matter what kind of work you're in and what your boss is like. Finances, what are our finances for? Jesus is generous with us. We are to grow our finances in such a way that we can become generous with others. Marriage, if you're married, husbands and wives both are to be like Jesus in relationship to one another in our respective roles. If you're not married, Jesus lived a fulfilling, satisfying, God-glorifying life being unmarried, and he did it by pouring into relationships with friends. He teaches us how to do that. Parenting. Parents, we don't exasperate our children. We seek to love and discipline our children like God does with us. Conflict. We seek to be like God and be a peacemaker in the midst of conflict. Love is not just an emotion anymore. Love is actually a duty. Love is actually an action where we substitute ourselves for others. We sacrifice ourselves for others' good. The gospel actually gives us hope in the midst of suffering. Jesus suffered for all of time, helping us to become like him in suffering, and one day he will make the world right. You see, in all the different aspects of what it means to be a human, the gospel actually gives us the foundation and the narrative structure to live into those realities. That's what God's given us to do. It's amazing. If you know the human heart, as the Bible describes it, and as you know the gospel, you know a great deal about how to live and how to change. Add to the goodness, knowledge. The last qualification is that we have to be teachable as a church, as individuals. Teachable. Paul says that the Romans were able to counsel one another. And the best counselors are those who are counselees. The best disciplers are those who have been discipled well and are continuing to be discipled by others. What that means is that if we want to help others change and help one another with our heart problems and with our soul needs and heart needs, we want to bring renewal into the valley. We must be continually seeking to change ourselves. We are people in need of change, helping others in need of change. We don't arrive as Christians in this life. We're humbly seeking to help others change because we are experiencing God's change in the moment. What's amazing to me as I look back over my life this week is that some of my greatest counselors in life, the people that I go to first to tell them what's going on in my heart and to help them or have them help me discern what's going on in my heart and how to change that, are people that I've counseled, people that I've discipled. There's a mutuality going on in our relationship. They're helping me and I'm helping them. My wife, fellow pastors and elders, and other Christian friends. Increasingly, our sons are beginning to do this. Help me understand my own heart and how to change. There's a mutuality about it. The more we know how the Bible talks about the human heart and our condition, and the more we know how the gospel applies to our desires, and the more we can trust one another's care for us because we know that people love us, there's profound counseling going on. Hearts are being changed. Now, ultimately, the goal of being a church that can counsel one another is not to give people our own wisdom. It's to restore one another back into relationship with God, the great counselor. Paul writes this in Romans 11, 33 through 36. Oh, the depths of the riches and wisdom and knowledge of God. How unsearchable are his judgments and how inscrutable are his ways. Who has known the mind of the Lord and who has been God's counselor? Who has given a gift to him that he might be repaid? For from him and through him and to him are all things. To him be glory forever. Amen. God is the one being in all existence that doesn't need our help. Not one bit. He doesn't need our advice. He doesn't need our counsel. He doesn't need our input. He doesn't need our power. He doesn't need our money. He gives us all things. We need his counsel. We need his wisdom. Because God is the one who designed it all. We just sang about wonder. He designed it all. We discover things in creation. We go, wow, this is amazing how this works. God put it there. God has creation on his resume. Think we can tell him anything he doesn't already know? The very breath from our lungs comes from him. Now, the sad state of affairs of the human race, though, is that we've thought that we can give God counsel, and we think that we know a little bit better than he does. Going all the way back to the garden with Adam and Eve in Genesis 3, God gave Adam and Eve counsel, instructions. If you eat of the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, you will surely die. And our forebears, our first parents, thought that they could give God some insight. Eve listened to the counsel of the serpent. I know God says that if you eat of it, you're going to die, but you won't really die. Did God really say that you shouldn't eat of it anyway? Putting suspicion into Eve's heart of the goodness of God. God gave instructions, and our first parents disobeyed those instructions, disobeyed God's wisdom. And whenever we disobey God's wisdom, what we're telling God is, I know just a little bit better than you do, God. You know, I've been around for 46 years. Almost in March. Eve saw that the fruit was able to make her wise, to make her like God. And instead of listening to the counsel of God, she listened to the counsel of the serpent. And the counsel of the serpent is always focused on you and me, on human beings having an inflated and prideful sense of ourselves. So Eve determined, and her husband with her, that the fruit was going to be good for her. And she determined good and evil for herself. And you and I have been doing that ever since. God, I know what you say, but I think better. I know better. Thomas Cranmer again says, the trouble with human nature is that we're born with a heart that loves ourselves over and above everything else in this world, including God. In short, we're born slaves to the lust for self-gratification. Left to ourselves, we always love those things that make us feel good about ourselves, even as we depart more and more from God and his ways. Therefore, God must intervene, and he has. God is their great counselor, so he will justly give us over to our own devices at times. But God is a great counselor, and so he is also merciful. And God has done more than simply reveal his wisdom in the book that we call the Bible. God has actually sent his son. And Jesus willingly came. And Paul says in another letter that Jesus himself is the very wisdom, the very counsel of God. Jesus said of himself in John 14:6, I am the way, the truth, and the life. Awana people, you know that verse. I am the way, the truth, and the life. What does Jesus mean? Jesus means that I am the way to God, and also I am the way to live. I show you the way to live. Jesus says, I am the truth. Truth is not some kind of abstract reality out there. Truth is a person, someone that you can know. Truth is not simply a set of rational arguments. It's an individual. Jesus says, I am the truth. And Jesus says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. Jesus lived the life that we're supposed to live for us. He died the death that we're supposed to die for us. And he rose again so that one day we will belong to him. But life is not just out there in the future. I am the life, Jesus is saying. That means that I am the life right now. Jesus has lived for us and died for us and rose again for us so that we can learn to live Jesus' ways right now. And what it starts with is finding your heart reordered under the ordered love of God. Instead of finding comfort in created things, ultimately we find comfort in God. Instead of seeking to control the things around us when we're anxious, we let God be in control because he's far better at it. We let God, his sovereignty, his goodness, his power, reorder our loves. Merciful Father, I ask, on this last day of our prayer for 21 days, God, I ask that you would work in us as a church to see that we already counsel one another. And so, God, would you help us and reform our counseling of one another and our neighbors, that we would be loving our neighbors, that we would be growing in our knowledge of the human heart and growing in our knowledge of you, and that we would seek that with every breath, with everything that we're given, until we see you face to face, that we would seek in our relationships to try to point one another back to you, the great counselor. You're the only one who can satisfy and reorder our hearts. Would you do that, God, and teach us to do that with one another? In Jesus' name.